From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Women make up only a third of state legislators in the United States. On Capitol Hill, the numbers are lower, with women holding only about 24% of congressional seats. They're not even a full quarter of Congress. And according to a recent UN study, the number of female heads of government around the world is down by 30% compared to 5 years ago. 100 years ago this August, women won the right to vote in the United States. That right came after activists suffered through political derision, jail, getting thrown downstairs, and other kinds of torture. Today, we'll take a look at how this right came to be for women and its intersection with the movement to abolish slavery and give African American people the right to vote. We'll explore whether women face a harder battle today on the road to elective office, and why, despite the documented gender pay gap, some say women don't have trouble raising money for political campaigns. We'll also look at whether Elizabeth Warren, Hillary Clinton, Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar face gender discrimination today. Joining me for this exploration, Barbara Burrell. She is Professor Emerita of Political Science from Northern Illinois University. She is the current chair of voter services for the Brunswick County League of Women Voters. Barbara Burrell, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Lazat is an assistant professor of U.S. history and material culture at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Jennifer Lazat, welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
With a Democratic presidential nomination of a white man born during World War II, almost a given, who is going to land on the ticket as the vice presidential nominee? The New York Times, in an opinion piece on this question, writes, "In politics, it's harder for assertive, ambitious women to be seen as likable and easier to conclude they lack some intangible, ill-defined quality of leadership." This keeps getting reaffirmed. Why, Jennifer Lazat, are women so naturally unlikable?
Naturally, of course, is a word that deserves historicization.
Go ahead and take issue with the way I framed that question, but there is a reason for it.
I'm sure. So yes, it is naturalized. So I look a lot at material culture and the way that objects factor into our perception of life historically. And I look specifically at dress. And right now I'm working on a history of the idea of dressing for success, the way that we present ourselves, comportment, attitude, manners of speaking, dress, hair, all of that plays into this idea that we can project an image of success and viability on the electoral stage, for example. And it's no secret that this past of dressing for success is a white male one. And that there has never been a standard for women looking professional, looking successful, looking powerful in an acceptable way. And I'm not saying it's because the power suit is a male suit that women can't get elected as in the highest office or many of the very high offices in this government. But there's a correlation. There's a relationship between our perception of success, power, leadership as masculine, and the optics of it, especially in a visual media-driven society.
And so then, is part of this, Barbara Burrell, reframing the way we think of what leadership quality means?
Oh, I think so. But I think if you look at, if you go beyond the presidential candidates and you look at the women candidates for Congress, in particular in 2018, there's a big movement in a different direction with them showing strength, showing military prowess, and linking it with being mothers, very much so. So I think they're doing their thing, what they want to, and many of them are winning or coming close to winning. So I think there is a big change.
So does this mean then there's a reframing of how we think about strength and leadership?
I think so, yes. Mm-hmm. And I think some surveys show that people like women, they like strong women, they like women just as much as they like men. It's just there's a structural barrier, though, to gaining elected office in our country, given the way the elections are structured.
What is this? Explain the structural barrier.
Well, first of all, you can only elect one person to, say, be a member of Congress from a particular district. So whomever gets the most votes wins. So that makes it very hard for minority candidates, for newcomers to get elected. People who are already in office, incumbents, are overwhelmingly advantaged. And I think we're going to be doing a lot of very interesting research on what happened with six women candidates for the Democratic primary, and now we're down, as you said, to two older white men, and what happened there. And, you know, maybe if there'd only been one woman or two women, they would have galvanized more votes than they actually got.
Well, that's an interesting theory. Why do you think fewer women in the race would have galvanized votes for female candidates?
Well, if they split the vote. So if, you know, Elizabeth Warren got 10% and Amy Klobuchar got 6%, that maybe Amy hadn't been in the race, and that's nothing against Amy, that maybe Elizabeth Warren would have been over the 15% threshold, which is necessary in order to get delegates. So I think it's just sort of splitting that a bit.
And, you know, right now, because the presidential nomination hasn't happened yet, we're looking at this on kind of a state-by-state basis.
Right.
So when we think about North Carolina and the recent Super Tuesday and the fact that even before that election happened, the polling showed the female candidates way underperformed mm-hmm. in North Carolina compared to the men. What do we make of that? And is it tied, perhaps, to the history of women's rights in North Carolina and the South? Jennifer Lazat.
Certainly, there's a correlation between racist histories in the South and sexist practices in politics and social life. If you look at the map on the eve of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, and you look at which of the states had ratified the 19th Amendment, guaranteeing women the right to vote in federal elections, then the big empty space is the Southeast. And
explain the process of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, just to make sure that we're all with you.
Sure. So the amendment which would become the 19th Amendment was first proposed in 1878, I think, and languished for many decades until it was passed by Senate in 1819. And then two-thirds of the states had to ratify that. I think there were 48 states then, so you had to have two-thirds of those states ratified. And it came down to, there were several southern states that had refused to vote, but all the rest of them basically had said no. North Carolina had not yet, and Tennessee had not yet.
They were considered undecided,
right? Undecided, absolutely. But so there's very dramatic event in August of 1920, when Tennessee representatives are voting, and there's a tie and a tiebreaker. And there's a really nice anecdote about the representative, Harry Byrne, and he was wearing the red rose, signifying he was going to reject the amendment. There's a lot of visual symbolism involved surrounding the vote. But then the story verified goes, he had a note from his mom, the ultimate Republican little r motherhood, urging him to do the right thing. And he switched his vote, seemingly at the last minute, if you go by his rose. And ratified was the tiebreaker and ratified the 19th Amendment. But that was one of the only southern states, Tennessee, that actually ratified it and achieving the passage of the 19th Amendment.
Barbara Burrell, when we think about the people who were instrumental in getting this country to that point, mm-hmm. who were some of those people?
Well, that's a fascinating question. And if you go back to 1848, the first women's rights meeting in Seneca Falls, I think it's totally amazing to think about 300 people, men and women, coming together in this sort of rural area to spend 2 days thinking about women's rights. As I told other people, I wish we could have done a survey. Who are these people? I mean, we know they're leaders. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott and all, who had sat down at a table. They had been very involved in the abolition movement, but yet they weren't allowed to speak. And so they sat down, they got angry, they sat down and said, okay. So they decided they would have this meeting, and then they said, well, what are we going to do with this meeting? And then they wrote up this fabulous, fascinating statement of sentiments about men against women, how they had betrayed them and tyrannized them, and came up with a list of items that they wanted to have passed. That they wanted to have more freedom for own their own property, to take care of their children, to be able to speak in public in the churches, but the right to vote, nope. Elizabeth Cady Stanton introduced that, and they thought that was way, way too radical. And only because Frederick Douglass, at least according to history, was there and spoke in favor of it, did a majority vote to include the right to vote. And so many years after that, it was more for property rights and things like that that they were lobbying for. And only after the Civil War, when they didn't get, women were not included in the Civil Rights Amendments, did they go to work. Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and others. And I think we'll probably talk about this later. There was a split along racial lines about what to do there.
That was in 1869, that split.
Right.
In part,
yes.
Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton separating from the other, the rest of the movement,
right,
because they opposed the 15th Amendment.
Right.
Absolutely.
Which
mm-hmm.
I'm going to ask you to explain when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. Barbara Burrell of the League of Women Voters and UNCW's Jennifer Lazat are with us today. We're looking at the history of women in politics in America, how far we've come over the last 100 years when women first won the right to vote. We'll be back after this short break. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. As Elizabeth Warren has ended her campaign for the presidency, we're taking a look at the history of women in politics. It was only 100 years ago this August that women won the right to vote in the United States. Barbara Burrell, Professor Emerita of Political Science at Northern Illinois University and Chair of Voter Services for the Brunswick County League of Women Voters, is with us, as well as Jennifer Lazat, Assistant Professor of U.S. History and Material Culture. They are both with us on this exploration. And just before we went to break, we were talking about the split in the women's movement in 1869 when Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton separated on the basis, in part anyway, because they opposed the 15th Amendment. Barbara Burrell, what was the 15th Amendment and why was that a cause of separation in the women's movement?
Well, the 15th Amendment was one of the three civil rights amendments. And it gave the right to vote to men, essentially, did not include women. And that's when they were angry that it didn't explicitly include women in the right to vote. It was the first time that any mention of sex was in an amendment.
African-American men the right to vote.
Yeah. Yes.
Right. And why was this, explain why this was a deal breaker for some women suffragists?
Well, I think they saw that as their one opportunity to get the vote for women, if women were included. And indeed, as Jennifer will tell you more, this is about some racism involved in the women's movement.
Jennifer Lazat.
Absolutely. So prior to this time, as Barbara had mentioned, abolitionism was key to galvanizing concerns and really making the women's rights movement what it was, surrounding the 1848 meeting and all the subsequent meetings in the 1850s and 1860s. That period was marked by a lot of cross-racial, cross-gendered alliances as part of the fight to end slavery and the fight to get women more rights, either property rights central to that, and then later arguing for the right to vote. So when in 1866, after the Civil War ended, there was lots of discussion about what rights were going to be given to former enslaved people and by what means. Several associations, like the American Equal Rights Association, were formed by former abolitionists and women's rights advocates to endorse both women's and black men's rights to vote. But when the 15th Amendment was passed by in the houses and was going to ratification was when the debates really started. And there was a famous meeting of the American Equal Rights Association in 1869 that kind of precipitated this schism. And Frances Ellen Harper was a black poet and women's rights activist and formerly an abolitionist who really believed that, okay, yes, women's rights are intrinsic and we have natural rights equal to those of men, but we have to take advantage of this moment, as did Frederick Douglass, who, as Barbara mentioned, had and continued to be a lifelong women's rights advocate, said this is the, quote, Negro's hour. But other activists, including Anthony and Stanton, said, no, we are going to form our own association and try to persuade Americans that black men should not have the right to vote before all women.
There is a story about three women, Margaret Hawkins, Augusta Chisel, I don't know how you pronounce that last name, and Estelle Young, largely unknown to the traditional historian. These women of Baltimore lived in the early 20th century, fought for racial equality as well as women's equality. Professor Ernestine Jenkins, a researcher of African American history at the University of Memphis, points out, and this was published in a USA Today piece, that the traditional narrative does often leave out large groups of women who don't fit into the white middle class story of women's rights. And black suffragists achieved what they achieved, seriously shaped the fight for women's equality. Why is it that their stories get left out of our traditional narrative? Jennifer Lazat.
I think there's a quick answer, and that goes back to who's written these histories. In 1876, Anthony and Stanton wrote the kind of seminal six-volume history of women's suffrage. And at this point, that schism was, there were different veins of fighting for it. The colored women's club movement in the late 19th, early 20th century was where black women operated primarily segregated from even after the two branches of the national women's rights movement rejoined in 1890. They took measures and they took pains to exclude black activists because they felt like it alienated especially southern white women from joining their cause and furthering the fight for the right to vote. So I think it has to do with who's written the history and who has been seemingly symbolically central to the fight to getting women the right to vote. And black women don't appear in that narrative historically. So this is a case of we need to revise the history as it's been written because it intentionally omits central players.
Barbara Burrell, I want to go to modern women who run for office. You've done some research on this and you've looked at how much money they raise as compared to their male counterparts. What did you find?
Well, I began probably 20 years ago addressing that question. It was the conventional wisdom. One of the reasons why women did not get elected to office in greater numbers was because they couldn't raise the kinds of money that men did. Well, I won't go into the long story here. I'll make it short. I looked at how much money women running for the U.S. House of Representatives had raised compared to men, comparing Democrat women with Democratic men, and so on and so forth, and found that by the mid-1980s, women were raising as much money as men were, and so the conventional wisdom was no longer true. And that's been a long story. There are still some people who don't believe that even today, that women can raise the money as men. Or if they can raise the same kind of money, they have to raise it in much smaller amounts. They have to work harder, and so on. But basically, my research has shown that for the most part, that's not true. And there are groups like Emily's List on the Democratic side that contributes huge amounts of money to women candidates.
And you've also looked at the competitiveness of women candidates. What did you find there, and what does competitiveness mean in the way, the lens you're looking
through?
Well,
If you're looking at it from a gender lens, do women get fewer votes than men? Women in the same kinds of races against incumbents, in open seat races, as Democrats, as Republicans, do they tend to get fewer votes than men? And again, conventional wisdom was wrong. Women were getting, by again, starting in the middle 1980s, women were getting as many votes as men. There was no sex discrimination in terms of the amount of votes that they got. Of course, then as well, how do they get them? Do they have to be better than men? Do they have to be more likable? Things like that that we're still looking at. Right now, some of us are looking at, well, if they run again, if they run and lose and they run again, well, what happens? Are they less likely to get elected the second time around than men? Or what do they have to do, like Jennifer was talking about? What do they have to do? How do they have to present themselves the second time around?
I have wondered about the role of kind of recursive sexism, specifically in this election, where it seemed so many people were afraid to vote for a Democratic nominee who was female because... if Hillary Clinton couldn't win, what chance would... I personally am fine voting for a woman and think a woman could do a fine job, but I don't think the rest of the nation would.
Right.
Do you think that recursive sexism played a role?
I'm sure it's one factor, one important factor in thinking about it. That maybe if I could only do whatever I wanted to do, I would vote for one of the women candidates. But I'm worried about... I want to beat Donald Trump if you're on the Democratic side. So we got to figure out who's most likely to beat Donald Trump.
Jennifer Lizotte, looking at dress and what that has meant in terms of and what some of the clothing choices symbolize for women, can you unpack the uniform today for strong female political leaders, what that says, what it really is? Because it does seem, with the exception of a few outliers, there does seem to be a uniform that looks very similar to the official uniform for dog breeders.
Ooh.
No, I do, really. What?
Or real estate agents.
Yes. What
agreed.
Is it?
And I got to give a nod to those women who are breaking that, like AOC, who recently went on wearing a sparkly outfit on national television. And people, of course, attacked her, saying, can you dress this garishly and be a serious political candidate? Which reminds me of the female strikers in 1909 who were scrutinized for what they wore, because can they be serious in their goals and still dress, quote unquote, frivolously? That's the kind of thing that women who are to be perceived seriously in any walk of life have faced. As far as political dress and business dress and dress of power and success, in 1975, there's a famous book written by John Molloy called Dressing for Success. And 2 years later, he wrote a version for women called Dressing for Success for Women, which is basically cautioning women. Well, yes, men have set the standard. So you have to dress in accordance to the power standard of men, but not too much. Right. So this narrow territory that we've already discussed of women having to, you know, appear assertive, but not too assertive, appear capable, but not too capable. It goes for dress. And I feel like it's really exemplified and expressed well in dress. Right. They have to dress staidly, respectably, rationally. Right. But not too masculinely. They can't appear to be showing that they're not going to be feminine. Right. This is an impossible standard to uphold, and it can be critiqued from interested parties in any number of ways, right? Either you're dressing too unfemininely or dressing too femininely and, you know, not being taken seriously as a candidate. And we've seen this definitely in critiques of Hillary Clinton when she ran in 2016. I don't feel like it might just be that I haven't encountered that there have been as many criticisms of the female nominees in this presidential election. And I wonder if that's because there are more of them. But maybe Barbara can counter this.
I also wonder if that kind of analysis got called out as sexist during the last presidential campaign. Would that be a factor? I mean, were people, did they just get more educated about how gender bias expresses in our analyses? I also heard people talking about the use of Hillary, when referring to the Democratic presidential nominee in 2016, versus the use of Mr. Trump. Mm-hmm. Barbara Burrell?
Well, that definitely happened, and she had a very narrow road to walk, and of course she had a history, too, that didn't help. in terms of, you know, being seen as being powerful and personable and somebody who could do the job. So I think she had more of a background that hurt.
You just said, sorry.
What did I say?
I just want to make sure I understand you. You just said she had a history that didn't help in terms of being powerful, personable, and able to do the job.
I meant her history with her husband, with the trouble in the supposed trouble in the Obama administration with her emails and things like that that really hurt.
Right.
And that Trump, of course, beat up on immensely.
Yeah, which any good political opponent would do.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also heard people say that some of the attacks that Hillary had to withstand during that campaign were gendered attacks, because had it been a man facing the same criticism over her email choices, for instance, her choice of, you know, not using the appropriate server, he wouldn't have been as pilloried for that. Is there any way to measure that or look at it?
I don't know. I mean, maybe you can compare what Joe Biden's going to face regarding his son, Beau. I'm sorry. I didn't mean that, because he's the one who died, Hunter. That he could really face a huge from the opposite side that might be very similar.
And going back to dress and what it means, when we look at the suffragettes and the suffragette white, many people know that that was a deliberate choice, but what does it actually represent? Why white, Jennifer Lazat?
Well, white has been taken as a symbol that was not quite as pronounced. There was a lot of symbolism in color in general during the suffragist movement. So suffragette was the term that was used in Great Britain. It was first applied negatively, but then British suffragettes took it over and said, fine, call us suffragettes. In the United States, they always preferred suffragists. But those suffragists used color as a form of spectacle during the first two decades of the 20th century, right? So I think of this one parade in 1913, the first national event that put the cause of suffragists on the front page of newspapers in the United States. Marchers were separated by profession, by country, by region, and they wore coordinating different distinct colors. So, for example, social workers wore dark blue, educators and students wore green, and writers wore white and purple. The main distinction was that, if you look at pictures of it, the women marchers stood out in their bright and light colors from the lines of men in dark stage suits on the outside. And this symbolic difference was meant to be a positive thing, that women do represent a kind of different hope, a different political spectrum than men. And that was one reason why it's good for them to have the right to vote. And women up to this period, suffragists fighting for the right to vote, often emphasized women's differences, whether it's we're the ones who have been given charge of the family, right, under the cult of domesticity. We're the ones who have fought for temperance, for families, for children. All of these movements, progressive era, female-driven grassroots movements, were tied up with the right for votes for women, as it became called. The campaign became called around this time. White as a symbolic color became more and more adopted for various other reasons. It was thought cheaper to get good white clothing. So this was an attempt to make broader class inroads for allies, for women, votes for women. And I think women of color have used this reflexively in that way, such as Shirley Chisholm in her campaign as the first Black woman to run for president in 1972. She appeared wearing white a lot. And I think the cross-class and cross-race symbolism there has picked up steam and solidified over the course of the 20th century, making it now a kind of intersectional symbolism for women's roles in politics.
So much of this conversation so far, when we've talked about modern day women, we're talking about either Democratic office holders or Democratic people, Democratic candidates. Are women generally more Democratic than Republican, Barbara Burrell?
In terms of voting, yes. Yes, there's been a gender gap since 1980. with women voting more for the Democratic candidate compared to the percentage of men who voted for the Democratic candidate. So and it's varied. Some years it's been pretty high by like 13%, and other years down to 6 or 7%. But yes, there's definitely a bias there, and as you can see that in 2018, with so many Democratic women being elected to Congress, and Republicans only elected one new woman, and a number of their incumbents left, so their numbers in Congress decreased greatly.
Is that true in North Carolina, do you think, that women tend to vote more Democratic than Republican? I mean, is that
I think so. I'm not sure that it's been as much research on voting in North Carolina.
You know, it's interesting. Holly Grange, a local Republican representative who has been in the state legislature, ran for North Carolina governor this time around, and in the primary lost to Dan Forrest, which I think may have been the initial larger GOP plan that Dan Forrest would go up against Democratic Governor Roy Cooper in November. But is there a gender issue there, or is that impossible to tell because it is an individual race? I mean, she got crushed.
She did.
100 counties went for Dan Forrest.
And, of course, he had been lieutenant governor.
Yes.
And certainly had all the money and all the power brokers in the Republican Party behind him. So it's a really interesting question. Why did she decide to leave her House seat and run for governor? Did she really think that she was going to win? I don't know the answer to that yet, but
you're listening to Coastline. We're talking about women in politics with UNCW's Jennifer Lazat and the League of Women Voters, Barbara Burrell. When we come back from this break, we'll see if we can trick our guests into making some elections predictions in November. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Women won the right to vote in August of 1920. That's right, not quite 100 years ago. Black men won the right to vote in 1870 with the passage of the 15th Amendment. And today we're looking at not only the intersection of the rights of African American people, the abolition of slavery, and the first women's movement, but we're also looking at how far those early American efforts have come and where traditional roles still define the culture and American politics. Jennifer Lazat is an assistant professor of U.S. history and material culture at UNCW. Barbara Burrell is chair of voter services for the Brunswick County League of Women Voters. She's also professor emerita of political science at Northern Illinois University. And I will ask you for those predictions later on in this segment. But I want to go back to the hand that women have in the outcome of elections, Barbara Burrell. This is something that you've looked at. Why is getting the women's vote so important for a candidate?
Well, there are more women in the population than there are men. So there are more votes to be had, first of all. And then women are now turning out at a higher rate than men. So that can make, when you've got like a million more women than men voting, that makes a big difference.
So there are more women and more of them vote.
Right. Then that of course, was not the case when women first got the vote in 1920. Maybe about 30% of the women turned out to vote.
How long did it take for women to start really exercising that right?
Well, what we know basically comes from the Census Bureau's surveys that have been taking place since 1964. They do a huge survey after each presidential and midterm election of the voting of the public, and find out who voted. They can't ask any political questions. But since 1964, more women than men have been voting. Because there are more women. But women have been voting at a higher rate since at least 1980 than men, based on these surveys.
And at the beginning of this discussion, I laid out the sort of bleak numbers, the fact that women aren't really represented in either at the federal level or the state level. And globally, the number of women in power in government seems to be shrinking, at least at the very top. But how are women, once they do get into office, in terms of working with, say, people from other parties?
Well, the perception has been that they are more bipartisan in the past.
That's a perception. We don't have research on that.
Well, we had a women's caucus in Congress for many years, and it had both Democratic and Republican women, and they have worked together on a number of issues, and they've worked informally. And several years ago, the women of the Senate won the Congeniality Award from Allegheny College, which has a big civic participation
The Congeniality
program.
Award?
Well,
That sounds like a beauty contest.
No, the first winners were Mark Shields and David Brooks from the NewsHour. So no, it's different, but that they were working together.
And then, is this the same thing as the prize for civility in public life?
Yes,
is that what it is?
Yeah,
okay.
And I think I have here in my book the picture of the men with their bowling teams. They were bowling, and the Democratic women wore blue, and the Republican women wore red. But they would go out and vote and bowl, not vote.
When was that? Was that when?
Maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
not in the distant past. But now they're becoming more extreme, and so there's less.
You mean
less
women are becoming more extreme this partisan divide grows generally?
Right. Yes.
Jennifer Lizotte, do you have any thoughts on the choice of red and blue for Republican and Democrat? Any theories on that? Do we know
where
that
question
came from?
Well, what I do know about that is the solidification. It might have happened around the same time you have the solidification of the donkey and the elephant as the symbols, which were negative, both originally negative and then kind of taken on as semi-enthusiastic mantles in the era of political cartooning being a really, really viable and popular form of political conversation around the turn of the century, right? When you have a lot of daily circulated newspapers and an interested public that wasn't always terribly literate, trying to keep up with politics, which was even more, which was quite divisive at that time as well. And you would get these representations of the parties. My guess would be that the colors representing them came about around the same time that the elephant and the donkey came to represent the Republican and Democratic Party. But I don't know why. I don't know exactly why.
Good question. No, yeah. I don't know why either.
Yeah.
Going back to the movement originally, Sojourner Truth is someone that we haven't talked about.
Yes.
And many people have heard that name, but there are probably many people who couldn't really explain who this woman was and what kind of a hand she had in the fight for equal rights. Jennifer Lizotte, can you just give us the thumbnail sketch of her and her role?
Absolutely. Well, you know, she is a fascinating historical figure, and she fought for... She freed herself, basically, when she grew up enslaved in New York, and when her slave owner would not release her after the New York's Anti-Slavery Act of 1827, she freed herself and walked away and had a very spiritual reconfiguration of self, renamed herself Sojourner Truth, and was a great orator. Went around talking about the similarities between enslaved people, enslavement, slavery, and the lack of women's rights. She was there at many of the major conventions. She helped form the American Equal Rights Association along with Black poet Frances Allen Harper. She, of course, gave her famous speech, Ain't I a Woman, where, you know, she argues that... So one of the biggest arguments, anti-suffrage arguments that both men and women made was that women didn't need the right to vote because they already had even greater protection under civic law because men only had the right to vote, right? So women had all of these things. Well, to Jordan.
Sorry, help me there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So because.
So women had greater protection.
Oh, yeah. This was the argument, right?
What was meant by protection?
Because men were socially, if not legally, required to take care of their families, right? They were considered the breadwinners, the economic source of income for most families, right? So, and they were the ones who were drafted into war. They were the ones who had to fight to protect women and children, right? And so both men and women would argue this is greater civic value than the right to vote. Also,
I don't understand
why
the I'm trying to follow just the narrative of the time, the logic of the time. And I'm why are those ideas mutually exclusive? Why does a woman having a voice in policymaking?
I think you have to consider the ideology of separate spheres. The fact that it was assumed that men were the representatives of the public sphere, that they went forth and had jobs and sought all the necessary details that it took to be an informed civic participant. Right.
Oh, so women
and
weren't informed. Because
place was in the home. And in order to be informed enough to be a good voting member of the civil society, you had to get out of the house. And this wasn't necessarily safe for women. So they would face all kinds of dangers in the public sphere. If so, this was one argument against women having the right to vote. And there are lots of very prominent anti-suffragist women who said this, said, you know, I don't want the right to vote because it's not that I don't think I'm smart enough. It's because I would have to do so many things that are antithetical to my role as the domestic head of my household, right? So I already have protection that men give me because they are doing this. They are going out and voting.
Is that related to the English law of coverture?
Oh, yeah. Yes, very much so.
By marriage, the husband and wife are one person in law. That is, the very being or legal existence of the woman is suspended during the marriage, or at least is incorporated and consolidated into that of the husband, under whose wing, protection, and cover she performs everything, and her condition during her marriage is called coverture.
So Joyner Truth made this exact same, claim that legally, there are similarities between enslaved people and women because of these laws. And it's no coincidence that 1848 New York marriage laws started to change the same year as the Declaration of Sentiments, as the women's rights movement really consolidated and began to gain steam, which arguably was lost after the schism separating them over racial issues. But it's important to me that Sojourner Truth, as both a woman and a former enslaved person, recognized this. It's a little bit easier for the Grimke sisters, who were abolitionists, who had been members of a South Carolina, I believe, slaveholding family who became abolitionists, for them to make that analogy from the outside. But Sojourner Truth had familiarity with both spectrums. And so her view is important for history to remember. And it's important also to remember that she did a lot of the same things that Susan B. Anthony did, for example, even trying to register to vote in 1872, where Susan B. Anthony got arrested, had this famous trial, excellent, really good publicity. She really was a master at managing the way people perceived the issues and sort of ridiculing some of the laws surrounding exclusion of women in the political sphere. But Sojourner Truth was doing the same thing, very separate by this point because of the schism between Black women's rights advocates and majority of white women's rights advocates, not all of them. But she also tried to register to vote and was turned away. It wasn't as dramatic, so it's not as good of a historical anecdote as Susan B. Anthony's story. But that's just one example of Black women doing equivalently or more to pave the path for the passage of the 19th Amendment.
Barbara Burrell, you have talked about on this path to women getting the right to vote, some women fighting for this cause were, of course, we know they were ridiculed, but they were also jailed, mm-hmm. and thrown downstairs, tortured. Tell us about that.
Well, when Woodrow Wilson became president and the Women's Rights Movement became much more active. And then Alice Paul, who was a member who had been in England and worked with the suffragettes in England, and they were much more militant. She brought those more militant tactics to the women's suffrage movement. And they started to stand outside the White House as silent sentinels, particularly after World War I, when women had supported the war and all, and they said, now you need to pay us back. You need, Mr. President, you need to, you're talking about the world. Well, let's talk about American women and rights in America. So they started standing outside the White House as silent sentinels, just stood there with their signs, never said anything. And then pretty soon the police would come by and take them away, and at first would just let them go. But then they got more and more agitated about these women, and in 1917 started to arrest them and put them in jail. They sent them, in a very famous case, sent them to this horrible jail in Virginia. And actually, Alice Paul was put in an asylum. They said they were political prisoners, so they weren't going to eat, so they were force-fed. They were thrown down stairs. You know, they were beaten. And
why were they thrown downstairs? So the force feeding.
The whole setup of the way the jail was set up, and they weren't going to participate, do what they were told to do. So they just threw them down the stairs, force fed them, treated them horribly, and then finally there was so much uproar against that they were let go. And they then had a parade across the country in cars wearing their prison outfits.
And hunger strike medals.
And Jennifer Lazat, as someone who also looks at this history through the lens of material culture, what's the connection between, say, corsets back then? Because corsets have been around for so long. They're making a comeback now, and they've been in different, we've seen them in different forms. Kim Kardashian actually famously talks about how wearing one has helped shrink her waist, and she showed up, I think it was it a MoMA dress? I'm not sure what the event was, but it prevented her from using...
It was the Met, yes.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it was. Prevented her from using the restroom because she had to, she needed a whole team to help her get into that, which is reminiscent of 100, 200 more years ago.
400 years of the corset. And I argue in my fashion history classes, it's never gone away. And I use the Kardashians exactly in body shaping, any kind of practices that morph the female body into whatever the current desired form is, which has changed historically much. But certainly right in the thick of that mid-century formation of the women's rights movement, 1848 to early 1850s, rational dress, or women dressing in a way that abandoned the more physically restrictive and disabling forms of dress. And I mean, do mean corsets, but not just corsets. Corsets have taken on many forms over the centuries they've been used. Men wore them, children wore them. They were considered healthful at various times. But in the 19th century, technology meant that tight lacing became more possible. In other words, you could use fabrics and materials that made it possible to cinch that tiny Scarlett O'Hara 17-inch waist, right? So the 19th century is one of the most restrictive, this mid-19th century, especially for Southern women. Forms of dress were physically very restricting. Not just the corset, but the 6 layers of heavy petticoats that made it impossible for you to navigate, for example, urban streets, which were covered with all kinds of muck that you'd have to drag your petticoats through. French heels, which were basically hobbling. They were hard to walk across. Again, navigate cobblestone roads.
Not meant for walking, really.
No, exactly. So there are a lot of debates that are published between both male and female advocates for rational dress.
And we're out of time. Quickly, who's going to be the vice presidential nominee? Jennifer, Barbara.
You mean for the Democrats?
Yes.
Well, it's definitely going to be a woman. It has to be a woman.
But we're not going to go so far. Okay.
Well, Stacey Abrams.
I was going to say that. I better not say that. Stacey Abrams would be, I mean, she is so dynamic. And
she would tackle sex, race,
everything.
We are out of time. That's this edition of Coastline. Barbara Burrell, Jennifer Lazat, thank you both so much for being with us today. Coastline's production team is led by Rachel Keith and includes Ken Campbell, Doc Jardin, and Marissa Castrino. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.